ever wanted to know about terrorism? From the world's greatest terrorism expert. No, that's not me, but my guest, Dr. Harvey Kushner. Welcome to the Terrorist Therapist Show. I'm Dr. Carol, a psychiatrist, and your terrorist therapist. I'm here to help you and your family reach your dreams despite living in a time of terror. Well, welcome to the show, Dr. Kushner.
It's my pleasure, Carol.
What did you say?
It's my pleasure to be on with you.
Well, good. I'm really looking forward to you. We could, you know, my mention of all your credentials could take the whole hour. So I will try to mention highlights. And if if I leave something out that you particularly want to mention, go right ahead. Well, first of all, Dr. Kushner is the Director of Homeland Security and Terrorism, the Director at the Homeland Security and Terrorism Institute at Long Island University. He is a best-selling author of several books about terrorism. He's advised elected officials, military personnel, and foreign governments, as well as trained federal agencies from the Department of Homeland Security to the FBI. He gives speeches across America, across the world, including the FBI and Quantico, the Army, the military, various government forces. He is the one who predicted 9/11 before it happened. But nobody listened. Nobody took, at least not enough to do what they should have done to prevent it from happening. Since 9/11, he's written books before 9/11, including The Future of Terrorism, which is kind of ironic, Harvey, The Future of Terrorism in 1997, The Future of Terrorism, Violence in the New Millennium, Terrorism in America in 1998. He was on Oprah for that, predicting the 9/11 attack. After 9/11, he wrote The Holy War on the Home Front, The Secret Islamic Terror Network in the United States, and the seminal classic, still classic work on terrorism is the Encyclopedia of Terrorism from A to Z, and it literally is from A to Z. There's a sort of a table of contents or a glossary in it where you can look up anything related to terrorism from A to Z. So, I don't want to forget perhaps the most important credential. He was featured in Penthouse it was on the cover, Top Terror Guru, Freelance Fanatics, Now Our Greatest Danger. Now, this was in a 2002 issue of Penthouse. And so basically, you know, what all this shows is that you were far before your time in all of this. And before we, you know, which I was saying before we started the podcast, that I obviously haven't been working on terrorism as long as my guest, nor have I accomplished a percentage as much, but it has been incredibly frustrating to me for the years that I have been working on it, how people are still in such denial. And I, you know, looking at all of this, it just boggles my mind how you must feel about it. You know, I may be wrong, but if I had started before 9/11 and done all of this, I think I'd be pulling my hair out by now. So why don't we'll get to that. Why don't we step back a bit and start with what made you, since 9/11 hadn't happened, and even 1993 hadn't happened, the attack on the World Trade Center of 1993. What did get you into this dark topic?
Well, you know, maybe today's discussion, Carol, you'll bring out, you'll analyze why I did. But let me go back and give you sort of the chronology. I grew up in a household where the military, my father was in World War II. My grandfather in World War One, and my family goes back to probably the Civil War time. And so that was always a discussion at the family table. And my father always was very interested in world politics, and particularly why men sort of rebel. Why do nations rebel? Or why do we have extreme violence, not on the individual level, you know, person to person, but more, you know, nation state. So, you know, at the dinner table, growing up in a period of time in the 50s, obviously, you know, family life was different. We didn't have as much television. We didn't read as much. We wouldn't have that type of material available. And so there was all of these stories that went back and forth. So from a very early age, I was always, you know, led into understanding the body politic and how things operate on national levels and international levels. So that got me interested. You know, I won't go into my spent childhood as trying to emulate the James Dean, but that aside, what's the best way to put it? I traveled the world looking, you know, to find myself. Then eventually decided to go back to school and take a learned profession, and majored in political science at the university, and pre-med, sort of chemistry, thinking I would either go on to do something in law or something in medicine or something possibly in political science. And therein lies the beginning. So immediately I got interested in that, and I went to for a PhD program and at New York University. And I studied in the 60s counterinsurgency, military strategy, guerrilla warfare. You know, we didn't use the term back then, terrorism, Carol. It really wasn't on the vernacular. The only way you used it was if you thought of the Reign of Terror during the French Revolution and Robespierre. But it was, you know, guerrilla warfare. It was certainly counterinsurgency and military strategy. So my training was really in that area in the 60s, you know, starting in the early 60s. And I got very involved in, you know, area studies, looking at particularly the Middle East and also the Soviet Union at the time, because they were number one enemy. And so I got a good, strong foundation academically in all of the literature and all of the strategy and tactics, whether from a military standpoint or whether from a political, religious. And so I had a really good background. And then once graduating and getting my PhD, I decided to select a profession which would allow me to expand my horizon and not be tethered to a desk necessarily, you know, for 40 hours a week. So I got involved in university teaching. I was very fortunate from the beginning when I started to landed an administrative post and, you know, been a university professor. And at the same time, this is, you know, more than 45 years ago, at the same time, I was able to begin a career in working for a variety of government agencies, both as a consultant and as, you know, someone employed. For example, I consulted, you know, both as a paid consultant and as a contributor to agencies such as the, you know, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, the U.S. Customs, Internal Revenue Service, you know, almost every agency, three-letter agency you could think of over the years. And I've also worked for example, the Eastern District of New York as their intelligence analyst over the years. And that, especially after 9/11, in which we created a squad of individuals who sat on known terrorists who were monitoring the living in the New York metropolitan area. So I got that firsthand experience while I was, you know, doing my university duties, also working for government agencies, and as well as outside consulting with governments across the globe. And throughout that time, Carol, I also got involved in a lot of cases which were monumental. For example, I worked on the first bombing of the World Trade Center in 93, I was an expert for two individuals who survived the B-2 level bombing, and we won a multi-million dollar settlement for them because they survived it from the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey. I also was an expert during the embassy bombing trial, which was the United States versus Osama bin Laden et al., in which I was on the defense team of Caliphate Khamis Mohammed. I was brought on by the government to put together his case during the penalty trial, but the penalty phase of the trial. He was convicted on 175 counts of first degree, and then it went into the penalty phase, and my job was to keep him alive. And we were very successful with that.
Wait. That's interesting. So you were basically appointed by the government to be on the side of the terrorist.
Correct. And there's an interesting story with that. It was a trial, if you remember, or your audience remembers, back, which commenced about the year 2000. It was for the two bombings, the simultaneous bombings of the East African embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. And at that time, as you should know, when we put these terrorists to trial here in a civilian court, as we did, they're entitled to representation.
Right.
And the government oftentimes spares no expense in hiring what they consider to be the best of the best to give them the fairest representation. So when the legal team was assembled for Caliphate Khamis Mohammed, who was responsible for blowing up our embassy in Dar es Salaam, I was contacted by the two head attorneys asking me if I would be willing to come aboard and put together a continuum, so to speak, of how to save his life during the penalty phase, because they were convinced that there was no way that the jury would find him innocent, but they wanted to. And the reason why I worked on that case was, besides it being a tremendous experience working in defense of an Al-Qaeda operative, but I believed at that time, you got to remember, Carol, this was before 9/11. Mm-hmm. I believed that we would make a Caliphate Khamis Mohammed a greater martyr in death if we than in life. Mm-hmm. So at that time, some of us believed that it would be better just to lock him away someplace out in Supermax, out in Florence, Colorado, for life. And don't make him a martyr by give him a public execution. We could spend the whole time just discussing that case. It's very fascinating how I was able to put together the case to save his life, which we did. And it's interesting because the end of the trial, Carol, was in August of 2001, almost 2 weeks prior to the bombing of the World Trade Center. Had we extended beyond the 9/11 date with the jury, we would have probably lost the case because the jury would have probably voted to execute him.
Absolutely.
Again, it was a different world. And I thought, and so did a lot of my colleagues in the government, that let's not make the man a martyr. Let's just quietly lock him up forever without a chance of ever getting out, like the only way he's going to get out is in a box like the blind sheikh just recently who expired.
Yes.
And that was that case. It's a fascinating, fascinating story surrounding the circumstances of that particular trial. And it was very interesting, in terms of being able to work hand in hand with a group of others who defended Caliphate. And it was also five others who stood trial at the same time as well, two of which were capital cases that had the penalty phase, and the other three didn't. All were found guilty for life with no chance of parole, and two of them also were excused from the death penalty. But fascinating case. So, that case I worked on. I worked also on the Empire State Building shooting.
Wait. So let me just ask you about that. So did you have, Did you have any, did you have to wrestle with yourself to, you know, you had already been really written books and been really into this very heavily. Mm-hmm. And of mm-hmm. course, the fact that you thought that he, that it was better not to make him a martyr, I guess, made you able to do what you did to defend him. But yes. After 9/11 happened, did you have any second thoughts? Did you think, oh, what did I do? I just spared this guy's life and look what they did, you know?
Well, you know, you would think so, but you know, not really, because it's such a complicated chain of events surrounding the 9/11. This was just a piece of it. If you ask me now, would I, in a similar situation, would I work to save his life? No, because, you know, sort of the genie's out of the bottle here, you know, the toothpaste is out of the tube. You know, we thought really that it would be better to keep the Al-Qaeda way of life in a box and not expose it as much to the world. But again, the world changed completely on 9/11. So the answer to your question is, I thought of it, of course. You know, I think you could understand it's like the child who puts his tongue against the light post in a freezing day in New York, or he hits the light post and the lights go out at the same time. There, he thinks he's caused the, you know, the power blackout. No, I didn't. But it's a fascinating story. No, you know, just to talk about that.
That's really interesting. I mean, even thought about it from that aspect. So I meant just, did you sort of think to yourself, I shouldn't have let him live? But you know, yes. So did you think, in other words, that somehow you were responsible? I mean, I know you knew intellectually that wasn't the case, but did you kind of, did you think that somehow that contributed to it?
No, I didn't. But a lot of other things that I did in my life, I had that feeling, which maybe I should lay down on the couch now and, you know, you can analyze me, you know, because I've always felt that there was more I could have done to inform the public, to get them aware. You know, it was always difficult to do that. I've come to grips with that over the last 30 years or more, 40 years. In a sense, the way I look at it is, I can't deal with that now. So what I've tried to do to get the angst away from how I felt about that was, you know, in my life, have a point and counterpoint, you know, look at beauty and look at the horror and, you know, and somehow get my mind off of it. Because, you know, I understand how the American public and yourself were faced with this horror, especially after 9/11. And it continues till this day. And people are always reminded of it when there's an attack in Orlando, or there's an attack in San Bernardino. Or when they get on an airplane, they're constantly reminded of this. You know, and I always, you know, I've lived with this for the last, you know, since I got involved really heavily. I can tell you the year was 1959. I mean, this is a long time ago. So, you know, when you're thinking of being involved years with things.
Yeah. What happened in 1959 that you can remember it as the starting point?
Well, that was, you know, the end of my high school and, you know, and I had to make the decision of where I wanted to go, you know, and I, as I said, I grew up with always hearing these things at the table, and maybe that's why I was looking to leave that world, that dark world, because, you know, my first entry into a career choice was, believe it or not, I went to art school.
Huh.
You know, I went completely reverse from what I heard at home. I went to actually Parsons School of Design.
Oh, wow.
Which is a very famous school. And in fact, my classmates were Jean DuPont, the daughter of Francis I. DuPont, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, Vanderbilt, Peter Fonda. I mean, you know, I was the only person from the real world with all of these dilettantes, you know, and people who I always got hung up paying for everybody because nobody carried money, you know, that type of thing. So I thought that, but then I reverted back to the real world of getting into what I'm doing now. But,
Before that, do you think you were, you mentioned Russia before. Do you think you were affected by, you know, how there were these, the drills, the get under your desk, the Russians are bombing drills?
Oh, I clearly remember them. I absolutely do. Not only do I remember them, I mean, I think our interview is going to go in a totally different direction, but it's going to be fascinating. But I'll tell you, I certainly do remember that. And I remember it in a very, very different way than I'm going to shock you. Maybe now you're going to get on the couch.
Yeah.
My family was in the hotel business. In fact, my uncle opened up the sixth hotel on the Strip in Las Vegas.
Huh.
The Royal Nevada, and he, you know, this is a whole family thing, and he opened up the Royal Nevada, which was the sixth, and on opening night, he decided to close it down to the public. Now you got to remember, Vegas back in the '60s and the '50s, you know, was like motels. They weren't these huge skyscrapers, right? And so his gift in the Royal Nevada was he had a big crown. On the hotel, a two-story hotel. In fact, when I was in Vegas, and I'm there like six times a year, I go to the Boneyard, which is to keep all the neon signs, and they still have, you know, the big crown from the Royal Nevada. But the point I'm making about this, to tie it back to the atomic bomb, he decided, again, my family is very prone to military. He decided that on opening night, he would invite the atomic soldiers to come to the hotel, and he had entertainment. He had Anna Marie Albaghetti open for him, and Sterling Hayden and Margaret Duma. Now, do you know who the Atomic Soldiers were?
Well, I'll
tell you. The Atomic Soldiers were, we developed the atomic bomb out in Nevada. And these Atomic Soldiers worked on the atomic bomb. And they used to test it out in the desert. And at that time, we didn't know what we did now, but these guys were very close by. In fact, when I was a kid, I remember when they had the testing, you would look out the window and you keep a piece of smoke glass to watch the flash, you know? So all these atomic soldiers since died, because they died from heavy radiation exposure. But so when you say, do I remember getting under the desk and the teacher saying, you know, no talking during an atomic attack, you know, and they pulled the black curtains down. I not only do I remember that, but I remember the testing, and I remember the atomic soldiers who came to my uncle's hotel in Vegas, you know, to celebrate what they did for America.
Wow.
And my other uncle worked on the Manhattan Project.
Huh.
He worked on the Manhattan Project. He was involved in the Enzio beachhead. He came off the boat on Enzio in Italy. He got shot in the back with shrapnel. He wound up at a hospital in North Africa. He wanted to go back in, but he was an engineer. He was studying engineering in the University of Kentucky. They enlisted him to work on the Manhattan Project. He didn't know what it was about, but he was working on a specific part for the atomic bomb. That was when they put together the bomb, which they dropped on, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I do remember that. And I'll tell you something else from your standpoint. It was only till about 15, 20 years ago that I was able to wipe that dream away. I would dream at night of a plane coming over and dropping that bomb.
Huh.
You know, that flash and that. The answer to your question in a very long-winded way is, That impacted on me too. And maybe it impacted on me as to how somebody could get to the point of dropping a bomb on someone else. And, that's why my interest was why men rebel, violence. And my specialization was Middle Eastern terrorism, which I believed at the time would eventually come to a crescendo the way it did, it is happening today. And so, you know, it was easy to me. I understood it. I understood the creation of Islam. I understand I understood the Crusades. I understand, the history of warfare. I understand the stopping of the Ottoman Empire at the gates of Vienna on 9/11 in the 1600s. So, I understood all of this history, and I'm a firm believer, Carol, that if you don't understand history, you're going to live it again,
Right, and right. So that's really super interesting that, all of these things, all of these different things had such a psychological impact. It was like, so from your early days, you were kind of, you wanted to find sort of the solution or the way to prevent these things from happening, another way to look at it is a way to protect America, and your books and your TV appearances and everything else is kind of a, when I started asking you a while back about, aren't you frustrated that people are in such denial? So it's kind of like you were sort of called in a way to wake people up and to try to prevent these things from happening from all of your exposure to sort of the worst of it or the extreme of it, of what could happen with the bombs.
You could say that. And my life has always been being in, you could call it this way, the right place at the right time. I mean, I remember back at New York University back in the 60s and the early 70s, talking to people about globalization. And, a lot of my professors there believe that that was the thing of the future. And with the coming of globalization, I believe that was going to make the problem worse, exacerbated, you couldn't stop this. You couldn't stop the world from moving in the direction that it's doing. You couldn't stop this revolution in cyber technology I never looked at it. I understood history, but I always was interested, Carol, in moving into the future. I always worked for the government, and most of my work stopped, though, really, when Obama was elected president, because quite frankly, Obama brought in people that were, God, totally politically correct. And, you couldn't identify who the enemy was in any sense. And so it was very difficult for me to operate, nor did that administration want me there anyway. But I worked in Washington, from going from the Reagan all the way through even the Clinton administration, even both Bushes, never had a problem with the consulting, with advice and all of this stuff. But when he came in, he just changed the whole thing. I do want to say that it's interesting because it's changing now completely. There's a complete reversal now. And we could talk about that. I mean, how the Trump administration will view it. But getting back to me, being in this sort of right place at the right time, I've always, everything that's happened, I mean, I've been involved, in like the Empire State Building shooting. I was involved in that one in which the Helmsley Corporation removed the metal detectors, a couple of a year or so beyond the 93 bombing. They took them out of the Empire State Building. And sure enough, the minute they took out the metal detectors on the Empire State Building, they had a shooting. An actual terrorist shooting, which this gentleman from the Palestinian, 68 years old, came here, was trained, and went to the 86th floor. And he opened fire and killed Mr. Bergmeister and wounded a fellow from Matthew Gross, I believe, in New Jersey. So I worked on that particular case involved there, showing that, they were responsible for the demise of Mr. Bergmeister and the injury of the other individual. And so many other incidents I was involved, too lengthy to name. I was involved in the case in Egypt in which a group of terrorists shot up a hotel there and injured an American dining there. I was involved in airports here in the country where there was attacks. And over the years, in seeing what was progressing and people not listening. Thank you for mentioning this, that I was there before this happened. But if people read my books, If they look at terrorism in America, I wrote Terrorism in America, and on the cover of Terrorism in America, it has the World Trade Center.
Yes.
And it has it has the scope approximately where the plane went in. Now,
I was wondering about that, because that was, unless you change the cover, that was before 9/11. So how did that come
about? I listened to these people, unlike our government did. Ramzi Yousef, when he was trialed in 95 in open court in New York, talked about a plot that he had called Project Brochinka, which was the hijacking of 12 wide-body planes over the Pacific and killing thousands of people, and some of them flying them into buildings, one building in which was the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. So if one just extrapolates from that, as well as he said in open court that his people were taking flying lessons and they weren't interested necessarily in taking off and landing, but keeping the plane stable. So if one would begin to take a look and connect those dots, it wasn't a quantum leap to understand that the World Trade Center was hit in 93. And knowing the mentality of the individuals involved in that, the Ramzi Yousef, because when he was captured in Pakistan and brought back to the United States, as he was coming into a landing here, he asked if he could take his blindfold off, and they took his blindfold off, and lo and behold, he was flying right over the World Trade Center. And the agent who marshaled was taking him back said to him, "Look at that, it still stands." He said, "Well, it wouldn't if we had a little more time." And so, what happened then is, and people, nobody mentions this either, that 2001, the mastermind of the 2001 taking down of the Trade Towers was Sheikh Khalid Mohammed. And who is Sheikh Khalid Mohammed? Sheikh Khalid Mohammed is Ramzi Yousef's uncle. and Sheikh Khalid Mohammed went to school here in the United States in the mid-80s in North Carolina. So, Carol, this isn't rocket science. This isn't, these things don't fall from, out of space. These plots are hatched by people with connections, and therein lies the issue. So, given my understanding of that, and given what has happened here in population shifts, and opening up different immigration patterns from different parts of the world where people came here with carrying all sorts of baggage, it wasn't a quantum leap to extrapolate that and understand that we're going to have an issue here. Look, Carol, in Holy War, I trained agencies in the mid-90s and before the 90s telling them exactly what was going to happen. Now, I'm not a seer. I don't have a crystal ball. But I just watch what happens in other regions of the world and understand the mentality of who our enemy is, being able to identify it, not, politically correct, where I couldn't call Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan, but all of that stopped. In modern times, you can't say radical Islam. And so, to me, it's as obvious as the back of my hand, what we face, the issues, and over the years. And it's always been difficult to get that point across to agencies. And quite frankly, I must have over the years trained tens of thousands of law enforcement agents, both state, local, federal, both here and abroad. And you know what? Oftentimes, it's not them. It's not the lower level, the mid level. The problems always exist, Carol, at the top of the ticket, because they are dealing with all sorts of other issues, not protecting the general public, and they're worried about being reelected. They're worried about, certain relations with other people. I give you an interesting story. One of the other being in the right place at the right time. I had a colleague of mine retired from the NYPD, and he called me up one day and he said, "Listen, I'm working on an interesting case. Would you like to be involved?" So I said, "Spell it out for me." So he did, and what it was these seven or eight different bodegas, sort of, all across the United States and in New York, particularly, with cutting these coupons that you get in the newspapers and people turn in, you know, when they purchase some coffee or some milk, and then they have an account. They have an account with a clearinghouse who then sends them, when they package it and send them, they send them the money, a check. Well, you know, without getting into all the details, you know, how it's done and all that, you know, it's not done through the U.S. mails, because if you get caught through the U.S. mails, it's a greater punishment. They have a FedEx account, blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, myself and this other individual, Ben Jacobson, his name was, we found out that all of these were Middle Eastern groups that were doing it. They were not selling these products. All they were doing is copying, you know, stealing recycled newspapers, cutting the clip-ins, bundling them, and getting the tens of thousands of dollars a month shipped into their account. Well, what happened, when he put the case together, went to General Foods and told them exactly what was happening. And General Foods declined to prosecute. Huh. They said they didn't want to go because they were all Middle Eastern. They didn't want to, start anything with that community. So it gets better. Ben then went to the Southern District of New York, and they said the case wasn't sexy enough. So the only group who published it was the New York Post and the whole thing. But what was interesting about that is that had they been prosecuted, one of the individuals was involved in the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. Who was he? His name was Mahmoud Abolima. He was the redheaded Egyptian chauffeur of Sheikh Rahman. So it's interesting. Had he been prosecuted years before, it probably wouldn't have been around to be involved in the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center. So, you know, Carol, you know, the question is, there's a lot of people, a lot of good people at the lower levels in intelligence gathering and law enforcement who do their job, but oftentimes it becomes very difficult when you move up the chain of command to really, you know, get something done.
Well, okay, so let's, you know, and that is still a problem and presumably a worse problem today. I mean, it's certainly better today than it was during the 8 years of Obama's reign when, you know, what terrorism, right? Terrorism doesn't exist.
Well, he called ISIS the JV team, if you remember, and you couldn't link together jihad, you couldn't call Islamic terrorism, you know. Right. He was treating it as some college professors do, in which, you know, you try to make it more abstract. You don't want to, and I understand that. I mean, you know, quite frankly, you do run the risk, and it can be insulting to people of the Islamic faith when you say Islamic terrorism, you know, because that's used more frequently than you use Christian terrorism or Jewish terrorism. You never hear that. So, you know, that's understandable. But, you know, again, when you put it in that frame, and then, you know, maybe I think the question you want to ask me is now, but therein lies a danger too. And I'll tell you why, Carol, because what happens, you then do extremes. And that's what I'm seeing in society. Like if you look at the new Trump administration, the Trump administration has no issue. The president himself has no issue with saying Islamic terrorism, radical Islamic terrorism. Well, you know, I understand that, but yet there are people on the other side that want to refrain from using it. I think the solution is somewhere in the middle. It's not excluding the name, and it's not using the name, because quite frankly, you know, there has to be the solution is not going to be military solution. It's not going to be a law enforcement solution. It's going to have to come from some other area. I think you know that. You know, when you have 1.7 billion Muslims in the world, there's no way we're going to be able to deal with it by treating it as a problem specifically to the religion. Don't you agree?
Well, I mean, you know, the point is that that it is these radicals who are using the religion. It's not really the religion of Islam itself necessarily that we're saying is making all these people become terrorists, but it's the terrorists who are using parts of the Quran.
Absolutely. I agree.
In a way that will incite other people. But
I agree.
But I think as long as everybody sort of has an understanding that when we say radical Islamic terrorism, that that's what we mean. It's radical Islamic terrorism. It's, you know, that's
I hope so. I hope that's the case. I really do.
It is kind of a problem with when, in the government at this particular moment where some of the people are saying, I can't imagine that Trump is going to stop using those terms since he's been saying it that way forever. But with Mattis trying to tell him not to do that. I mean, I don't think we should get bogged down in what it's called. I think people just need to sort of wake up and see, this is where I was going, that I think we're going to die by political correctness. And that's
no,
the
big I agree.
Danger.
No, you have no argument for me. None. What I'm saying is we tend to operate now with extremes. That's what I mean. Let me rephrase what I mean. The last 8 years were horrible because the last 8 years, we had a president who refused to recognize the issue. Really refused to recognize it and treat it, and by doing so, the ones he created a reaction to him to some extent that was quite extreme. I think the beauty of our society, the beauty of this country, was that we somehow walked down the middle, whether we had a large middle class economically or the way we thought. I think what we did is we sort of moved it to the middle. I mean, you know, even the way religion was interpreted by our founding fathers, I don't think was an extreme view. They believed in God, they were deists, but they weren't fanatical about their beliefs. And I think that therein lies the beauty. And I think what we've had now is we have a polemic where we have, you know, opposite sides. And when you have such extremes, you can't find a pathway down the middle, down the center. And I think that therein lies that. Look, I'm not going to deny to you that Islam right now is not the stage of Christianity. I mean, Christianity had some horrific times in its past, you know, for example, the Inquisition, you know, and the Crusades, both sides. But there was a reformation in Christianity, a reformation in the Western world. I don't think that has taken place yet in Islam. I think that's what's happening. That's going to take some time. So what I'm saying is I want to call it what it is. I do believe it's correct to call it radical Islam or militant Islam. Absolutely. But I'm saying that eventually we're going to have to come to a conclusion, a solution through some other means, which is going to bypass the religious aspect of it.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Because
we're
not going to convert. They're not going to convert the West, and we're not going to convert them. So there has to be some way to get along. And you know what? There is the answer to that might lie in different cultures. Because when you think about it, Carol, we have problems with certain countries like Pakistan. Okay, we don't have the same type of trouble with the world's largest Islamic population, Indonesia.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? So it's, we need to exploit all of those types of things. But
yes.
No, I agree with you. We have to call a spade a spade. And as I said, during World War II, we weren't at war with Blitzkrieg. We weren't at war with kamikazes. We were at war with specific enemies, which was fascist Italy, Imperial Japan, and Nazi Germany. And now we're not at war with terrorism. We're at war with militant Islam. Absolutely. I don't deny that for 1 minute. In fact, you know, everything points in that direction, you know, and whether or not you want to say the blame is us, you know, because of our foreign policy, which is sort of like blaming the victim, you know, and that, which I don't agree with, you know. Nevertheless, we got to figure out how to get around this. And what concerns me in studying terrorism, you know, but particularly Middle Eastern terrorism, because quite frankly, I wasn't a fan of the Irish Republican Army, Carol, or Shining Path, or Ba'ath Separatists. But, you know, I didn't view Ba'ath Separatists as a threat to people living in Brooklyn, or did I think the IRA was a threat to the people living in Boston, you know? But I always knew militant Islam was a threat to us here in the United States and the Western world. So
where do you see, because we're kind of coming to the end of our time here, where do you see, I know you're not, you said you weren't a seer and all that, but where do you see things going from here? I mean, you know, you predicted 9/11. What do you think is going to be happening in the next 10 years even?
Well, I you know what I think? I hate to say this. I don't want to give anybody ideas, but, you know, I talked about freelancers and lone wolves back in the early 90s. But quite frankly, I think there's going to be another horrific type of event. And I think the reaction by the American public is going to make the USA Patriot Act look like a liberal document.
Yes. Because
I'm very disturbed about the way we are acting. You would be better able to tell me because of your training. You know, we tend to put things off. We don't have any long history. You know, after 9/11, we passed the USA Patriot Act, and we put it in a sunsetting clause, which means that after a certain period of time, the sun sets on it, and it has to be reissued again. We're 15 years plus after 9/11. Why haven't we come to any kind of a conclusion about the USA Patriot Act? Why haven't we put, we don't. We wait till the shoe drops. We're never proactive. We react to these things. And so what concerns me is, yes, you're right that people have forgotten and turned away because they want to get on with their lives. I'm concerned, though, that the next time it happens, and it might be in a, I don't want to say where it could be in a very horrific situation, a school, a house of worship, a hospital, some horrific 9/11 type of Hiroshima type of act. I think the American public, again, will react in a very extreme way, because I think we need our leaders, and hopefully the Trump administration will do that, to call attention to the problem and deal with the problem, even though it's not in the front pages of the newspapers this week. Because mark my words, there will be another attack. The enemy, if you think of all of the pressure points in the world where we've been involved, and we should do another show on why we should have never got involved in the Middle East and put our finger in that hornet's nest. If you think of all the people that that are ticked off at us, there's a lot of jihadis out there. They're saying now, they're touting that we're beating ISIS, we're taking away land. That might be true, but I'm still very disturbed about the tens of thousands of individuals who will go to fight on the side of ISIS and step up to the plate in their name. I mean, you take, for example, a country that you know, you're familiar with, Belgium, how many fighters they had that went there to recruit to fight, or London, and here in the United States. And you know, therein lies a major problem. And then you put that all together with modern communication, social media, and news being instantaneously out there, we have a problem. We have a major problem. And quite frankly, I'm at a loss for an immediate solution to dealing not only with ISIS, but also from all of these other individuals worldwide that are stimulated to do people harm, whether it's here in this country, whether it's in Pakistan, or whether it's in Iraq, or whether it's in Mali in Africa. You just can't keep it behind a closed door.
Well, we've become, in the 8 years of Obama, we have become so much more vulnerable to terrorism. Yeah. And, you know, in so many cases, whether it's people who are, wherever they live, it's people who are disillusioned with, well, like in America, with the American dream, that they're not going to get the American dream and they feel cheated and they want attention and want to do something, want to leave a legacy. And if they're not going to be able to leave a legacy of something positive and really important that everybody appreciates them for, knows them for, then, you know, so, I mean, so many people feel like they have nothing to live for, that they'll even die, you know, even though they'll be a suicide bomber, or they'll know that it's likely if they do such
well,
and
well,
such.
Well, right, right. Well, you're absolutely right. That in is, look, that's the problem. But what concerns me more than that, there'll always be people like that, is that the horrific acts of terror and the thought process is filtering into people who are not, you would think, would be criminally insane or have some other type of issue. You know, just by a mere fact of not dealing with it exacerbates the problem.
Yes.
You know, when it can, you know, so how do you deal with all of those people who need to be? Because quite frankly, I'm finding it very disturbing, and this is not terrorism, but if you look at these town hall meetings, Carol, if you look at the town hall meetings, if you look at political rallies, whether it's to the left or whether it's to the right, and you look at the animation, you look at people's faces, you look at what they say, their verbiage, this is, it's very problematic, I think.
Yes.
You know, this is, to me, is not a, you know, a civilized, I don't want to say it, but you know, I don't mean to, you know, to denigrate anybody on the left or the right, or but this behavior is just, you know, it's,
yes,
it's not structured. It seems violent in some aspects. Don't you think?
Like,
I mean, you know,
it's like we've become as primitive as the terrorists. You know, at some of these rallies. I know, it's like it's the steam is being built up all over the world. Of course, I relate that and have for years to all the violent media that has been spewing out.
Right, right, right.
And causing everybody to become more aggressive, whether they attach it to a religion or to a political belief or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, this opens up all sorts of things. Why I try to analyze it is, you know, if you look at today, when I grew up, I had some toy soldiers, and they were usually in three or four different positions, and I, you know, have to move them around my hands. Today, with the animation and the reality, and you know, how much violence did I see as a kid? Yes, I lived through the time they were going to drop the atomic bomb and that, but through newspapers. Today, kids, by the time they reach their, you know, puberty, have been exposed to tens of thousands of violent incidents.
Yes.
Am I right? I mean, this is incredible. I look at my grandkids, and my grandkids sit, you know, from 6 year old to the 16 year old, the five of them, they sit there, and all of them are electronic equipment.
Yes.
And the 6 year old has the skills to operate things that I would have never been able to. Crying out loud, I didn't know how to dip my pen in an inkwell. You know, and she's able to do all of this. And so when you think of the exposure that they have, and then look, I'm getting off, but talking to you is wonderful. You know, when I was growing up, the pornographic literature was Lady Chatterley's Lover and Fanny Hill, or Tropic of Cancer. Need I say more about what's available to people today?
Yes.
So, you know, so if you do that, if you think about that, and you think about all the possibilities and the learning experiences in the other part, regions of the world, my God, I mean, where is this going to end, Carol? You know, where is it going to end?
Well, I'm sure you will tell us in your next book, which we actually have come to the end right now. But is there a book in the works that you would like to tell us about, or in your mind at least?
Yeah, I do. I have a couple, you know, but it's just, you just got to be able to put pen to paper. It's, as you know, with your book that's coming out, which I think is unbelievable, and I think it's totally necessary. Because I, you know, I wrote an editorial for a New York paper here back in 1980 something, saying what your children should know about terrorism, and everybody looked at me like I'm a nut job. But I think what you're doing is, you know, very important, because I think when you don't discuss it, and it's discussed in back rooms and all of this, it's dangerous. So looking forward to it coming out and getting a copy. Okay, Carol?
You're on the top of the list. Well, I'd like to thank you so much. Yes, we could obviously talk for hours and hours, and you'll have to come back. Well, I you don't have to, but I would like to invite you to come back.
I would love to, yeah.
And thank you so much. As I said at the beginning, everything you ever wanted to know about terrorism from the world's greatest terrorism expert, and I'm sure people are recognizing that it is you. So thank you, Dr. Harvey Kushner. And thank you all for listening to the Terrorist Therapist Show. And I'm your terrorist therapist, Dr. Carol Lieberman.